Today on Backroom Today on Backroom Politics, Sarah Palin creates her own little thunder in the aftermath of a huge Republican loss in New York 26. We'll get some updates on the current fiscal crisis facing the global community from our report in the G8 conference from Dr. Ralph Winnie. And we're going to have a special segment talking about redistricting. The congressional district in New York's 26 will have ramifications on how everything gets redrawn. Plus, tell me a story. This is Backroom Politics. It is time for only cigar roundtable for politics and current affairs. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., a very hot and steamy nation's capital. As they are with me every Tuesday is our usual roundtable of political pundits. To the left of me, politically and figuratively, he is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd District. He is the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
I'm delighted to be here.
And sitting across from me directly here at Shelley's, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, former Vice President of Government Affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Always glad to be here.
And to the right of me, back after a long extended vacation and trip to the G8.
Not vacation.
Oh, it was a working vacation.
Yeah.
He is our international pundit. He is the Vice President of the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in Washington, D.C., in the great city of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Had a great time at the G8.
And we're going to talk about that here coming up. But first, we want to talk about some political news that's starting to simmer a little bit. The big news out of Washington, there's so much going on in Washington, as there is every week. But the big news we're going to start off with today is what happened over the weekend, and actually since our last show. A lot of things happening in the Republican Party that need to be discussed. The first one I want to talk about is something that actually kind of gripped me over the weekend. I was kind of torqued by it, but we'll talk about that. For those who do not know, every Memorial Day there is an event that comes to Washington D.C. called Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder has been a tradition on Memorial Day. It started off as Vietnam veterans on their motorcycles coming to the Vietnam Wall to call attention to the POWs and MIAs that are still unaccounted for. It is a very solemn event. It is a very moving event. It is very much a non-political event.
It's a very patriotic event.
Very patriotic event, absolutely. And it is something that everybody should see, to see just hours of motorcycle riders in solidarity to bring notice to this kind of a cause is truly, truly, it's moving, it's emotional. It is truly something that makes you realize the sacrifices that those who serve in uniform make every day, and to those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. But the reason why we bring up Rolling Thunder, and I urge everybody who's out there listening, you should come to Washington, D.C. and at least see it once. But the reason why we bring that up is there was a new movement that happened this past Rolling Thunder, this past Memorial Day, which kind of got me a little bit upset. In and out type of presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, we still don't know what she's doing, made an announcement that she was going to kick off her We the People bus tour here in Washington, D.C., and make a tour through the Northeast Historical Corridor, which would include Philadelphia, New York, and ultimately end up in New Hampshire, a leading primary state in the electoral process. She kicked it off on the same day as Rolling Thunder. She did it on a day that followed the loss in the New York 26th congressional district, where the Republicans got handed a very painful loss
for the first time in about 30 years.
Exactly. That came as a shocker to a lot of political pundits inside the Beltway. But the reason why we bring up Rolling Thunder is I got a problem with Sarah Palin politicizing something like Rolling Thunder. It just irks me. And the thing about it is, the organizers of Rolling Thunder have always said this is not a political event, and they've kept it that way for over 30 years. It has always been something to memorialize those in service and those who are still unaccounted for. I ask the question because I'll give my opinion after I go around the table, but, you know, Al, when we look at Sarah Palin showing up at Rolling Thunder, the media circus that shows up after her, and again, I want on record, I am a Republican, okay? I this is not a criticism of the former Alaska governor. It is a question of her timing on all this and her politicizing a truly non-political event. Am I off base in making this assessment that it was truly more to feed the political media beast than her showing solidarity to those?
I think you're exactly correct. It's very interesting. Sarah Palin seems to have an extraordinarily good ear for right-wing extreme positions and those who hold them. She can turn them on. She can get their attention. She can sell her views. She seems to have an incredibly tin ear for the broader kind of politics. For example, that she was invading an issue which was nonpartisan, which was honoring the dead and missing in civil wars and so forth and so on. And that's just what you come to expect from Sarah Palin.
Bob, her people have got to be involved in this decision.
Sure.
And is the governor's staff in this political process in Sarah PAC, are they that far removed from what the reality is that they can make a claim saying, okay, she's just writing? Now, let me clear up before you answer that. It should be noted, in defense of Governor Palin, anybody who wants to ride can ride in Rolling Thunder, as long as they understand it is not a venue for politics. But her people have got to know that.
Of course, they have. Well, let me put it this way. If they don't know it, what the blank are they doing? So, first thought. Second thought. And I don't know if it was a political, you know, he was doing something to raise her political venue or whatever, a little bit her situation, but I would say this about it. Even if she is totally innocent of any political motive, it still is a bad idea for a politically engaged individual in the public eye to go there and do anything that could be seen as politicizing something that has never been politicized. Even if she's innocent, it's not a good idea.
Is the perception right that she made this a political maneuver, or is there a certain naivete that we have to chalk this up to?
Look, as I said, this woman has a very good ear for how to grab publicity, particularly aimed in one direction, and this would have fit that crowd as well as many others. So she had to know what she's been doing. But she strikes me, just watching her over time and reading about her, she strikes me as somebody who doesn't like staff around her who tells her no.
Right.
So she may have piled on staff that's basically there to say, yes, what a wonderful idea that is, Governor.
Right.
And in which case, she's got nothing to protect herself from herself.
The thing is, she's coming across as more of a celebrity rather than someone that has policy ideas, someone that understands the way the economy works, even on an international scale.
Right.
She's perceived as a real lightweight. This instance really portrayed her as some sort of political lightweight, as a publicity stunt, and her reputation as someone who quit her job to go on a reality show still hasn't seemed to have evaporated.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, and by the way, for those of you who are out there listening who would like to comment on this subject or any of the subjects we're going to talk about, please feel free to dial in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We'll put you on the air live with our roundtable. I want to touch on your comment as far as celebrity. There's a ton of celebrities that have ridden in Rolling Thunder. One of them who comes into Shelley's quite a bit, the actor Robert Patrick, saw him this weekend. He's ridden in several of these, and he's never really asked for the publicity that surrounds a celebrity going into this. And they've always done a good job of keeping that this is just for me, not for the publicity.
And Palin did not do that.
No.
It was as if she was trying to gain some sort of cheap publicity, and people are seeing through it, and they're very upset.
It's as if she was trying to top Donald Trump.
What?
Okay, all right.
Wow. Is that possible?
She doesn't have enough hair.
Wow.
She's not coming across as someone that's a policymaker, a thinker, or a leader. She's coming across as a celebrity, and that's not the image she wants to have if she's going to run for president.
You know, the truth of the matter is, it's too late. That's what she has become. She can't be. She's no longer a politician.
You're right. I absolutely agree.
You know what? And that ties into a comment that Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann made in a recent interview, calling Sarah Palin, basically saying, quote unquote, she's not a contender, which means that she is more of a celebrity than she is a true, viable figure in the political scene. Al, would you agree with that? Is there some sort of hybrid maybe between the two, or does she have to pick a side now?
Well, I think Bachmann is gradually becoming a celebrity. She is doing a lot of things to draw attention to herself and so forth.
But in defense of Congresswoman Bachmann, she's doing it as a seated member of Congress, and she's made her intentions known. She may be running for president, Bob.
That's exactly right. She is acting like a politician who is trying to decide whether she's going to get in the race or not. And that's legitimate. She's talking politics stuff. I think Palin has just sort of moved away from being a politician to being a celebrity, period.
I'm waiting for somebody named Hilton to get into the race.
Wow. Be civil.
Bachmann's problem is she has made some factual inaccuracies when she's spoken.
And that's
going to hurt her. Not a celebrity issue. It's going to come down to issues that she has commented on and where people have said, you've got your facts wrong.
But what would lead any politician to the Washington insiders know you don't make a stump speech at Rolling Thunder. You don't bring the media pool to Rolling Thunder. You ride, and then after it's all over, you can say, hey, I rode, I'm in solidarity. You just don't do that in the staging area over at the Pentagon.
But even the best politicians sometimes put their foot in. Look at the Newt Gingrich's kickoff was a mitigated disaster because he was trying to make a point which was not going to go down well with the right wing of his
partner. He didn't say it well.
You're referring to the comment about Congress or Chairman Ryan's budget bill.
Yes, and this guy's a good politician, but he really muffed it there. So even the best make mistakes.
Bob, do you think that there could be fallout from Sarah Palin politicizing Rolling Thunder?
I don't think there's going to be much fallout for one reason. I don't think she's going to be running, and it doesn't make any difference. The only fallout will be people who are offended by the fact that she did what she did, but it's really irrelevant from the standpoint of politics. I think she is a spent force. Now, I think she'll probably, at some point, let's assume that there is a candidate who is running, who she supports vigorously. I think she'll probably try to take whatever strength she has within the Republican Party and suggest to that group that their candidate should be whoever Palin likes. Right now, I think that's all she's going to be able to do.
Well, Palin doesn't listen to advisors. She and her husband seem to make all of the decisions.
Right.
And that kind of plays into some of these issues with Rolling Thunder, where they're not smart decisions. And if she had listened to a top savvy political advisor, she would have taken a different course.
A few more dumb ones, and she's not going to have the standing to do what Bob suggested, which is to support the candidate of her choice.
Right. At this stage in the game, and I put this out to everybody, is Sarah Palin a viable candidate for president, or has she, in fact, crossed that line into celebrity?
Bob said it. She's a spent force.
Really? Bob, you agree with that?
I said it once. I'll say it again.
Ralph?
Yeah, I don't think she's viable now. She had a lot of potential when she first ran. She gave a wonderful speech at the convention in 2008. I thought it was one of the best speeches I had ever heard. And the commentary at the time was, this is a woman that's really up and coming within the Republican Party. But ever since she left the Alaska governorship, or quit her job, as some people want to say, she's become more of a celebrity and really hasn't gained any traction in pursuing a policy-driven agenda.
Let's look at the other side of this. Not to pigpile on to the former governor, but Sarah Palin, in fact, has she's had political credibility. You don't get elected the governor of a state by not having some political credibility. Do you think, Al, has the media been somewhat unfair in judging Sarah Palin?
I don't know that the media has judged her. A lot of comedians have.
Right.
In the entertainment area, there's been rather harsh, but I think serious criticism and disagreement with her from a variety of quarters, both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party. I think she was up to being governor of Alaska. She wasn't up for going nationwide yet. She missed a couple of steps of experience on the way to running for president.
Do you think, Bob, that Sarah Palin may have been overwhelmed by the media focus on her?
Well, I think Ralph said it very well. She probably peaked her popularity at the convention because she was a wow at the convention. But you'll recall that there were a few interviews shortly thereafter where she couldn't answer some pretty basic questions like what...
I.e. the Katie Couric interview.
Yeah, like what news magazines do you read or things like that. And, yeah, I think at that point, the bloom came off the rose a bit. And no matter how much she struggled thereafter, it seemed like she was dogged by one problem after another. And it's probably, some of it was bad staffing, but also I think it was just that remind yourself, here's a person who, I don't mean to belittle Alaska, but she may never have left that state for all I know. She was at home and she was the governor, but she had, she wasn't a politician beyond her state at all. And she was suddenly the number two person in the Republican Party. And that is something that I think was just suddenly...
It's a pretty serious slingshot.
Yeah, it's a huge stair to call, steps to climb.
Right.
And you didn't have... She did... I mean, literally, the day the convention is over, people are wanting to talk to her. Get her on this program. Get her on that program. And ask her about things that legitimately, as an Alaskan governor, she had no reason to be thinking deeply about.
Well, she got very angry at Couric because when they asked her what books do you read, Palin took it as an offense that Couric was looking down on her because she was not an intellectual. And what Palin should have done is said, look, I read A, B, C, and D. Now what do you read?
Right.
And then that would have been the best approach rather than just refusing to answer the question.
That's been a huge argument on Palin all along. I mean, she's clearly not what we would think as a political intellectual, but in defense of Governor Palin, she does bring a blue-collar, down-home approach to politics that does resonate to a lot of the electorate, particularly those in middle-income, middle-America. She is somebody that people can associate with, affiliate themselves with. So I go back to the question is, has the media been unfair to Sarah Palin?
Well, and the other thing was she took on a corrupt Republican administration in Alaska. And I have a lot of respect for her for doing that. But nobody in the media seems to want to point that out or give her a credit.
Well, I agree with that.
But your question, who hasn't the media been unfair to? I mean, it's the nature of the media, alas, and for shame. But I don't think that, given the things she's done, she's got any worse treatment from the media than anybody else.
You know, we talk about your former employer, Bob, NBC, Saturday Night Live, has portrayed Barack Obama. They portrayed John McCain. They portrayed, but it's
Gerald
the one,
Ford.
Gerald Ford.
Ford.
Yeah. Unceremoniously
yeah.
as being a klutz.
Yeah.
Everybody's been the target of the late night, the late night comedians
and
hair.
That comes with, that's part of what we do now.
Except for maybe Obama until very, very recently.
Yeah. Well, Obama hasn't been in the national public scene. For as long as he's been in the national public scene, he's always had, you know, somebody taking a swipe at, particularly in his presidential run. But I just think that, you know, we need to focus a little bit on, you know, the quality. And that's what I'm going to reverse it back to the original topic of, I would hope that with her political insight, that she has enough understanding of what's kosher, what's not kosher, enough to say, hey, this is something I need to do, or this is something I just need to back away from. It doesn't seem like that filter's in place.
Well, here's her problem. When she goes into a state to campaign, you're supposed to be a team player. You're supposed to contact the Republican Party and work with the chairman and the state party apparatus on setting up your events. She doesn't do that, and that's generated a lot of bad feeling among people at the grassroots level.
Well, let's talk about that. We're going to take a quick break here for 2 minutes. When we come back, we're going to follow up on that one, because that's going to tie into the talk about what happened in the 26th Congressional District of Western New York. She was up in New York. She was vocal about it, but she was not vocal for the party candidate. She went and supported the quote-unquote Tea Party candidate, which is something into itself. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Just you and I, we
And we're back here live in Shelley's back room for Backroom Politics with our usual roundtable, Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, myself. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. If you're joining us from the last segment, and by the way, you can call in and discuss any of the topics that we're talking about. You can call in to 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. To kind of tie into what we were talking about in our first segment, talking about the situation where Sarah Palin politicized a very solemn and very patriotic event in Rolling Thunder by her participation. We're not questioning her participation. We're just questioning the political motives behind that, and there's a lot of people inside the Beltway that are questioning that even today. But it ties into a larger problem, I think, that the Republican Party's having, and that is probably most evident as a result of last week's special election in the 26th Congressional District of New York. A huge loss for the Republican Party, where the Democrat, in an upset, Kathy Hochul, came out and just unseated a truly staunch Republican base in that congressional district. I look at Bob, you've been around the GOP and the RNC for a long time. How big of a blow was 26 New York to the party as a whole?
Well, it was a very clear signal that the issue of Medicare is a very politically dangerous one to take up. And even with all the effort that you can make to put a good program out there, and even when the other party doesn't have a program and they just say, let's keep doing what is too expensive anyway, we're spending 11% of our federal dollars on Medicare. Can't keep that up. But the point is, you know, we have to do something. And the Democrats said, the Republican proposal is going to change Medicare as we know it, and we're all going to be damaged by it. And the voters took heed that, you know, most people think Medicare works reasonably well, which means if when you're going to change it, you have to have a very good argument to make, and you have to make it clear and simple. And quite frankly, it's not an easy argument to make, and the Republicans suffered thereby.
Well, the Republicans need to clearly articulate their vote on Medicare and what it means. They have to defend their position. They have to reassure people that Ryan's plan is something that's going to be beneficial in the long run. The Republican candidate didn't do that. She didn't respond to the baseless attacks of Kathy Hochul and let Hochul sort of define the issue on Medicare rather than coming out and saying, look, this is a good plan, and it's going to help everyone a lot.
Well, now, that ties into something that was actually kind of surprising that we heard from Majority Leader Eric Cantor on CBS's Face the Nation. His comment was that Medicare was, quote-unquote, undeniable that it played some role in the election. He also went on to say, as far as Medicare is concerned, there's a simple choice here. Either we're going to save the program or let it go bankrupt. Does that shock you, Al, as far as Eric Cantor commenting that, hey, Medicare was the one linchpin that lost New York 26 for
us? No, I think that's a pretty realistic view. Let me ask another question. What was the total that the Tea Party candidate got?
8%. The difference was 5, I think.
Right.
Now, I think... But what that says is that the Tea Party didn't draw very well. It drew from the Republicans. It was involved. But while we're trying to weigh how this issue affected the Republicans, it's very interesting to me that the Tea Party, for all of their supposed influence and everything, didn't pull more votes in that election.
That's a very good point. But arguably, there was one advertisement that I thought was absolutely reprehensible. That was apparently a factor in this election was the advertisement that supporters of now Congresswoman Kathy Hochul, it showed a lookalike of Paul Ryan wheeling an old lady in a wheelchair up to a cliff and throwing grandma off the cliff.
Yeah. It's a very effective scare tactic, and the Republican didn't respond accordingly.
I got to tell you something. That's a little over the top.
I agree.
That doesn't address a scare tactic.
It's way over the top. But each party has one. The Democrats have the Medicare and Social Security that they have been demagoguing for as long as they've been around. And the Republicans usually can figure out some defense military kind of thing about how the Democrats are soft on communism or now soft on national security and what have you. And both parties have been using those two things for years very successfully and very dishonestly, in my judgment. And certainly pushing grandma off the cliff is beyond the pale.
Well, let me say this. I don't think there's anybody in this city who has been here at all and been involved in any political activity who doesn't know that Medicare, as it exists today, is in fact going to go over a cliff if we don't do something about it, because the dollars just aren't going to be there. There's no way you can have 25% of the government revenues going to the Medicare program, and that's the way it's gone. It's just too much, so we have to find a way to do something about Medicare, and everybody knows that means you're going to have to adjust some of the moving parts about how much people have to pay, how much the doctors get. You got to be more efficient and do better ways to do what we do, and those are the things that have to be done. And apparently, I mean, if the Republicans get scared enough, the Democrats are going to have to live with what happens, and it's going to be a disaster in 10 years from now.
The unfortunate thing is, and I think Bill Clinton has articulated this clearly, the Democrats win in New York almost becomes an excuse for the Democratic Party to do nothing about Medicare. All they're going to do is just use these scare tactics.
Sure.
Meanwhile, the program is going to go down the tube.
And we've got
to reform it. There's no question.
And what they should be doing is they should be saying, Ryan has got it wrong. Here is the way you do Medicare.
Right.
And they make the adjustments that will please their people.
And the Republican did not call Hochul on that. She should have said, well, what's your plan for Medicare?
Well, there's another factor in this that we're not touching on, and that is the Jack Davis factor, the third candidate in this. Now, Jack Davis is a lifelong Republican who switched Democrat. He tried actually seeking the Democratic nomination for this seat in this election, failed, and went back to Tea Party, and drew a lot of the Tea Party base to him, to the detriment of the Republican Party candidate.
The 8% or 8.5%, I think it's 8% that he got, is a larger number than the difference between the Democrat and the Republican in the election.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you could look at it and say, had he not run, the race would have been extremely close, and Republicans probably would have won.
Republicans would have won by at least 3%.
Well, probably. Now, maybe they wouldn't have gone. All the votes wouldn't have gone to him. But the fact of the matter is, that is fundamentally a Republican district.
Correct.
It's been a Republican district for 25 years, 30 years.
And it will be so again, depending on redistricting.
Yeah.
But the Democrats shouldn't get too overjoyed about this, because I suspect she's...
This is probably going to be a one-term shot.
But it sure would be nice if the Democrats would do just what Al said. You know, there are a lot of things we don't like in the Paul Ryan proposal. Here's what we would like to change, and here's how we change it. Then we would have the kind of conversation going that everybody talks about, an adult conversation. Nobody seems to want
it. Why haven't the Republicans pushed them to do that?
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, you know, when we talk about the election separate from what the Democrats should do regarding Medicare, there's no question. Right now, the only individual, and we said this on the show many times, the only individual that's showing any sort of leadership in fiscal austerity and fiscal spending is, in fact, Paul Ryan. There's nobody from the Democratic side. There's nobody from the Tea Party side. The only person who's basically gone all in is Chairman Paul Ryan, to his credit.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. But I think something else that should be known is he is, let's say the Democrats did what I proposed. They
right.
Say, okay, you know, here's the way we would change it so it would be acceptable, da-da-da-da-da. That's when Ryan then has got to start negotiating. And I don't think his Tea Party's going to let him do that. In short, if the two parties can have an adult conversation,
well,
it seems to me that that the Republicans are going to be going into negotiation with one hand tied behind their back by the Tea Party.
I think that there is some truth to that, Al, which I think one of the reasons that, as an example, today the House of Representatives is voting on the president's proposal to raise the debt ceiling $2.3 billion
right.
over the next 2.5 years or so, 2 years. And they're going to vote it down.
Right.
Now, I think that, you know, they also have voted on, you know, their own proposal, which the Senate, you know, voted down. I think what we're seeing is that the leadership in the House, which the leadership in the Republican House, the biggest problem they've got is making sure that the Tea Party folks get a chance to make their statements. And in both those votes, one in proposing and pushing their own vote over to the Senate on how to on what to do about the budget and Social Security, and the other one going to be voting down the budget, the deficit increase bill today, what they're giving the Tea Party people a chance to do is go back home and say, look, we're voting for exactly what we would said we were going to do, and we're doing everything we can to get it done. But at some time, you know, we're going to have to give a little bit because those Democrats in the Senate are a bunch of turkeys and the White House is the same. That's the argument that they have to be able to take home to their people so that they feel that they have a chance to win the election next year when the Republicans may not have a good candidate.
Well, let me throw a wrench into this works here real quick, because, you know, when we look at what happened in New York 26, no question with the Medicare issue was decisive in the election results. There's got to be a point where the RNC has to start taking some responsibility of not just being the fundraiser. It's got to help drive the platform and the messaging. The question I have is, where's Reince Priebus in all this? We've seen Debbie Wasserman Schultz be very active. In fact, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairwoman of the RNC, kind of called it ironic that the architect, Eric Cantor, of the scare tactics in the 2010 election is saying, hey, the scare tactics in 2011, now that wasn't right. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is getting, where's Reince Priebus in all this?
You said that she was RNC, she was DNC.
DNC, I'm sorry.
Well, she's been a very activist chairman. I mean, she is on the ground, she trains their candidates very, very effectively, and I think the Republicans are been kind of caught behind the eight ball in terms of
Al?
I personally think that both parties should throw their hired guns, their paladins, out of the room while they're talking policy. And Ryan kind of did that. and the Democrats obviously have not. They're playing the same old game. The hired guns only know how to win elections. They don't know how to write policy. And they get in the way and they say, oh, you can't do that. No, you mustn't do that. And if you do that, you know this will happen.
But Al, aren't we being a little bit naive to think that the two aren't intertwined?
I think it is. It may well be naive, but I'll tell you this. Let me tell you a story.
All right.
Along with Guy Vanderjack, we were the co-chairs of an effort to come to some kind of campaign finance thing. There were agreement on reform of
right.
campaign financing. We had an equal number of Republicans and Democrats.
This is pre-McCain-Feingold.
Oh, yeah, this is pre-94.
20 years.
Yeah.
And Guy would chair one meeting, I'd chair the next, back and forth. And my Democrats came to me at one point and said, this particular provision here has got to go. This is clearly designed to benefit the Republicans. It is clearly designed to hurt the Democrats. And we don't care how you do it, but you've got to get that off the agenda. And I, well, I've been given my marching orders. I can't lead a group that is not going to follow. And so I was trying to figure out how I was going to talk to Vanderjack about this. He comes in, it was his turn, he starts the meeting, and he says, Al, we Republicans really do want to try to work something out on campaign finance. But there's this one provision in the bill, which is so clearly to the benefit of the Democrats, and so clearly aimed at the Republicans, that it's got to go. You guessed it. It was the same damn provision. And what was happening was the hired guns in both parties, with all their paranoia in full blossom, were both against it. Well, I told the guy that about 2 years later, and he retired by then, and he got a kick out of it. But the fact is, our hired guns are sometimes the worst possible people you can have in the room when you're trying to work out policy.
And I would say this. Most of the people who are become national chairman of the parties are there because they are good organizers and fundraisers, which is exactly what they should be.
Which is what Reince Priebus was brought in to do.
That's
he is
correct.
Phenomenal at that.
That's right. He is correct. He is. I don't think he would pretend to be a policy wonk. I don't think he would think he should be at the table with Mr. Boehner and Mr. McConnell when they're making policy. They may want to invite him in on a particular reason for some point. But fundamentally, in my experience, at least in the Republican Party, the National Committee chairman has only on two occasions that I can recall been fundamentally involved in policy. One was when Bill Brock was the chairman.
Right.
And the other one was with Ray Bliss. And I think everybody, and that's going back a long way.
Yeah, that's going back.
But Ray Bliss was probably the smartest guy I ever saw operate politically.
Oh, I mean, we've seen powerful RNC chairmen. We've seen
powerful, but that doesn't mean they make policy.
I would disagree. Yeah. I would go back to Haley Barbour. I would look at somebody like Ken Melman, who came out of the policy side to become chairman of the RNC.
Making policy when he was at the RSC for the most
but
part.
I would argue that he was probably driving platform issues, which ultimately goes to policy. I think we're seeing it now with the past two. I think we've seen it with the past two Democratic chairs, where we're seeing it. Tim Kaine, you cannot tell me that Tim Kaine was not involved in the platform to policy issues. I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to be even more
so. May I suggest to you that platforms are dead the day your candidate loses. And usually, sometimes, even if you're going to win, it's dead the day after the convention.
and besides, the political people that I'm talking about, that I call the hired guns, are the ones in the congressional campaign committees that are calling
the RNCC, the DNCC.
Yeah, because they're looking out for the political asses of their members, the congressmen and senators.
But let's go back.
Not the chairman of the party.
But let's go back to the effect, because all of this discussion focuses around, almost ironically, back to what happened in New York 26. The New York 26 issue shows, I'm going to throw this out there, it shows, A, there's a huge disconnect in the national ability for the Republican Party to really rally the troops alongside where it needs to be for the party candidate, and two, it's showing almost a reversal of fortune where now the Democrats are starting to use some of the same tactics that the Republicans used less than a year ago in midterms to their own advantage, with the Republicans kind of standing there holding the bag on, you got me.
And I met Jane Corwin when she came to D.C., and the questions were asked to her about how is this Medicare issue playing out. Oh, there's just a few rumblings, but I've made it very clear, and our polls tell us that my future constituents understand that Medicare has to be reformed. So there was a complete disconnect with what she believed. And
which I go back to the fact that, I mean, we have a special election in a seat that has been Republican for 30 some odd years. Mm-hmm. At some point, the National Party's got to get involved and go to Jane Corwin and say, "Hey, Jane, look, here's the deal. Here's the platform. Run, go forth, and prosper." That doesn't seem to have been done with, especially with the fact that Jack Davis can come back, go Republican, Democrat. Oh, by the way, now I'm Tea Party.
Well, what does it say about the voters?
Well, that brings up a whole other issue now.
But I would.
It's a good question, Al. What does that say about the voters?
Well, first of all, the idea that she thought that the people understand the issue is
it's insane.
Because nobody's explained it to them. The Democrats haven't.
Well,
Obama hasn't.
Well,
she claimed
that she had, and that she had clearly articulated, and that they understood. They were not going to react favorably to the Democrats' negative attack. The structure of the Ryan proposal is a complex thing, and I doubt there's any 30-second commercial you could make, or a minute, or a 5-minute speech that you could make that would make it clear to people what was going to happen in what period of time, 10 years out. It's so easy to say, let's push Mama off the cliff. People understand pushing Mama off the cliff. Boy, there goes Social Security. There goes Medicare.
What
there goes whatever it is.
But what they don't understand is that Grandma's going off the cliff
anyway.
Right. Well, very valid point.
And neither party has done a very good job in making that case, which I believe is a lot simpler to make.
Yes, that's the case. I would almost say that if I was a Republican,
which you are,
a Republican operator,
right?
I would have taken them off the cliff, and I would have done just what Al said: push her off the cliff and say, you know who's pushing her off the cliff? The Democrats, because they won't change the system that's going broke. I'm here to tell you, Paul Ryan's system is a better solution. And they didn't do it.
And that's what Corin should have done with her ads.
That's
She just chose,
exactly
to ignore
it. That's what I would have done. And then every time the Democrats use that ad, it would remind the Republicans and the voters that it's wrong. Right now, the system is going broke.
So let me ask this question. Al, did Jane Corwin, the Republican candidate for the 26th Congressional District, did she miss the boat as far as conveying the right message to the electorate, even though the electorate seems, in this case, to have a 30-second attention span?
Well, she apparently missed the boat in thinking that it wasn't an important issue.
Now, and the question is, I don't know when she was in town, and I don't know when the Democrats' key ads were first put on the air. You know, there's a lot of candidates who go into an election, you know, a month out or 6 weeks out, and we can name them from last year.
Right.
Who think they've got it going. And then suddenly, and I think most of them last year were Democrats, and suddenly the Tea Party strength came into play and people got blown away who didn't expect to be blown away.
And they're left without a seat when the music stopped.
Yeah, because they thought a month out that all they had to do was keep doing what they were doing, and they missed something.
Al, and besides, it's always amazing to me that candidates can't see what seems to be obvious to everybody else, that they need to respond. John Kerry and all the group that ran all the ads about
it?
Swift Boat.
He let them just say that he was basically a coward.
He didn't earn the medals.
He lied about all of that. And his response was, I never heard it. I don't think he responded.
But that goes back to a much larger platform that we at the First Congress Society talk about. That's bringing the civility into politics. Swift boat ads, the pushing grandma off the cliff ads, goes back to, hey, let's stick to the facts. Let's stick to calling John Kerry a coward is asinine.
You can say a lot of things about him, but you can't say that.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
Anyone who
not.
Serves his country in Vietnam is not a coward.
Or worse, they defeated in. Was it Georgia or Alabama, a senator who left three limbs on a battlefield.
And he
Max Cleland.
And they
Georgia.
Defeated him on the basis that he was not patriotic.
Yes. And that gets back to the much larger platform, which ironically, this all ties into, whether you want to call it the mistakes or the successes, depending on which party you are, what happened in New York 26. So I go to this, and before we go to break, I asked the roundtable this question. Is New York 26 in the special election, is this a wake-up call for both parties, Al?
I think it's a wake-up call for both parties, and I think the Republicans will get it. I'm not sure the Democrats are going to understand that they can't just stand pat throughout this whole issue and this whole election.
Bob?
I would agree with Al completely.
Ralph?
I agree. I think the Republicans are now going to go back and be sure to respond to any of these kind of attacks in the near future.
Well, we're going to be talking about this topic for a while. This is not going away. We're going to take a quick break, a quick two-minute break. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Democrats.
Wow. And we're live back at Shelley's Back Room here in Washington, D.C., 1331 F Street, across the street from the National Press Club. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me, as they are every Tuesday, this is our second hour. He is the former eight-term member of Congress and former vice president of Burlington National Railroad. He is Honorable Congressman Al Swift.
Burlington
Northern. What did I say?
National.
Burlington Northern. I get it right sometimes.
It's minor. Number Burlington Northern Santa Fe.
Anyway, yeah, so I get the name wrong every week anyway. He's the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, former vice president of government affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Sitting to my right, as he is every Tuesday, is our international pundit and international authority on all things financial. He is a bar certified attorney and vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie.
And no matter what the rest of us say, at some point he's just going to start talking about the G8.
I know. We can talk about redistricting, and eventually we're going to talk about G8. Yeah. Actually, we're very fortunate. We're going to close the show today with a very interesting talk. Hopefully, we'll get drive time listeners. We're going to talk about Ralph's experience over in the G8 and the topics that are coming up. Big one that announced today is Greece apparently has got another guardian angel. We'll talk about that in our last half hour. Want to talk about something a little bit more higher level, a little bit more theoretical. It's something that we've been talking about for a long time. I think the New York 26 race comes into play when we talk about this. A lot of states right now are getting the census results, and a lot, actually all the states now are going through something they go through every 10 years, and that is a redrawing of legislative districts, whether it's at the state legislative level or even at the national congressional level. These districts are being redrawn as we speak. We've often talked amongst ourselves over lots of Jack Daniels, martinis, and whatever wine Bob happens to be drinking that day. And
vodka,
whatever.
Thunderbird.
There we go. So we've talked a lot about the concept of redistricting, and it's been an issue that's kind of taken a different track every time we talk about it. So I thought, you know, with the First Congress Society being active in inequality, fairness, and civility in politics, this would be a good time to go back to our roots and talk about redistricting, particularly with the effect it's going to have in this coming November's election. First of all, why is redistricting important now? Why is it something that every American needs to be cognizant of as the process goes forward?
Well, it's important, and for the reason it's required is also important, and that is population shifts and the one-man, one-vote rule requires you to change lines so that you equalize the population in congressional districts every 10 years. The real issue here, and this can get very, very complicated, but the real issue here is, should this be done in a way where the people choose their representatives, or in a way where the representatives choose who they choose to represent? In other words, do you draw the district for your benefit as the congressman, or do you draw it for the benefit of the people who will then elect a congressman or woman? And that's the anchor of the whole argument. Then we get into some complexities, which
right.
are also important.
Bob?
Well, following up on what Al said, most of the districts that exist today for the House of Representatives of the United States Congress probably are at least 65-35 in favor of one party or the other. They are not compact and contiguous districts. They look like funny animals and Roche block pictures and blots on the ink. They don't look like compact and contiguous districts where a community is together, and that community may have a variety of different kinds of people rather than just one block that is a Democrat or a Republican group. And the problem is that if you are running in a district that is 65% in favor of your party, your biggest concern as someone to get elected is to win your primary, because you're most likely in a district that is, let's say, substantially Republican. It's 65-35 Republican. You're going to have a pretty conservative block of voters. Now, if you're not a real conservative in your point of view, the attack you're going to have is going to come from the right, and the attack is going to be a very strong person on the right side of all the issues, the right side. If you're a Democrat, it's the opposite, 65%, you're going to be attacked by a very wild and crazy liberal. Now, what does that do? Well, that means when you get elected, you are pushed not to the middle of the where you make a compromise between the two parties, but you're pushed to the extremes, where each party is pushing their extreme point of view rather than a moderate point of view.
But whose fault does this lie with, Bob?
It lies with the congressional members who make deals with the state legislators to fix the districts the way they want them.
Okay, now then let's go back for a second and let's talk about traditionally how redistricting happens. Traditionally,
Elbridge Gerry.
Wow, Elbridge Gerry. Wow,
Governor of Massachusetts.
Wow. Well, bring it up. Talk about it.
Elbridge Gerry goes clear back to the beginning of this country, and he did many important things. While he was governor of Massachusetts, he did what redistricting came to be, and it got to be called a gerrymander after Elbridge Gerry, because he drew one district that was so distorted it looked like a salamander, and they named it a gerrymander.
Right.
We've been doing that ever since.
235 years.
But how is that something to be proud of? I mean, it sounds like this is insider politics, backroom deals, and
exactly.
We should be able.
I want to say one thing because it shows you the extremes to which it can happen.
Yeah.
10 years ago, California had 53 congressional seats. 53 seats stayed with the same party, either with the same person who was running for re-election, or in an open seat, the party won, who the member was there in the same party. 53 seats up for election, 53 were won by the party in who had the majority. And they have a traditional way of setting up the seats. The state legislature, talking to the congressional delegation, cut the deals. Now, in Iowa, in the same election, Iowa had 6 people running for seats in the congressional delegation. They had 6 members of Congress. They have a commission made up of former governors and members of the state Supreme Court, and they drafted compact and contiguous districts, not gerrymandered seats. 3 seats changed hands because of the change in population.
build a dream house of love, dear, near to the sun in the day and near to the moon. Lovely tune.